Hello and welcome to the Private Markets podcast series from Said Business School at the University of Oxford. I am your host, Ludovic Falipou, and I am Professor of Financial Economics here. Today's episode is Real Estate Laid Bare, and I happen to be just back from the investment committee of my college endowment, in which we spent quite some time talking about our large real estate portfolio, and in particular talking about our holdings of farms. We have quite a lot of farms that we own and let out. And yes, you can invest in farms, we do. And I wanted to know a lot more about farms as an investment in particular, but also real estate in general. And for that, I invited two fantastic guests. One is Andrew Baum, a professor of management practice at Said Business School, and the other one is Paul Kennedy, a management director at JP Morgan Asset Management, and he is also an associate fellow at Said Business School. So I'm looking forward to talk with them about real estate laid bare. How much is this the world of farms? Like, how much money could one invest in that?
Various estimates would suggest it's a few tens of trillions of dollars, maybe $30 trillion.
Although it has to be said that nobody knows.
Nobody knows. So there are various estimates. But the key point, there are people who have published numbers. So Savills and other commentators have published numbers. Those numbers vary because the methodologies used to estimate them vary. The key point, though, is that a very large part of those holdings, such as yours, are held for a long period of time, had been held for hundreds of years by single owners, and therefore are simply not investable. So a very small fraction of the overall investable of the overall stock should be viewed as being.
Yeah, every year there are not that many farms coming on the market because we are hunting pretty aggressively with this college for farms, and it's pretty rare that one comes on the market. We restrict ourselves to the UK, but right now, like Eastern Europe is pretty hot, and Latin America, there are quite a lot of farms coming on the market there, but also like the volumes are not raised.
I mean, there's only a very small chunk of the market that you actually gain exposure to, and the exposures that are available tend to be very, very lumpy, which limits not only the accessibility for large investors, but particularly limits the accessibility for smaller investors.
We've already stumbled across an interesting point about real estate, and that is this idea of being on the market, not on the market.
Yes.
I mean, everything's for sale at the right price.
Right, like the most of these houses are owned by individuals, and you know, if you pay the right price, they are for sale, but there is not really a liquid market for an institutional investor.
I mean, again, numbers vary. I mean, you can get numbers from, I think you quoted numbers from Savills suggesting about 90 trillion globally. I've seen numbers that are slightly higher. So the numbers depend on the methodology and which number of countries you include. But the key point, again, as you state, is that a relatively small proportion of it is owned by institutional investors and is therefore accessible by other institutional investors.
So if we were to scale this, you could say that the world of real estate is, let's say, 220 odd trillion. That's a Savills estimate. That's everything. Within that,
including commercial?
Commercial, farmland, residential, the lot. Within that, say 90 to 100 trillion is houses, some of which are investable, some of which are owner-occupied and therefore not investable. Within that 220, 30 trillion, there's probably around 30 to 40 trillion, which is owned by institutions who are prepared to report their ownership into some sort of benchmark. And we would call that investable for sake of a better word.
But technically, like you said, even if it's owner-occupied, if someone wants to buy my house at the right price, it's theirs.
Investors have been looking for different sources of yield and different sources of exposure, or sources of higher yield and sources of different underlying exposure. Forms of real estate that would have been outside the institutional market 10, 15, 20 years ago are coming inside the market.
Just like private companies are.
Yes.
Becoming part
absolutely.
Of the investable universe.
Exactly the same theme, actually, within private equity, where you're seeing growth of private equity, not because additional companies are being created, it's just because capital is looking to take companies that are public, private, for various reasons. But
and I think these new forms of real estate are probably a bit better for the argument that you want to diversify using real estate. Because if you think about like the traditional institutional investments in real estate, like shopping malls or these sorts of things, I'm not sure that if a shopping mall, if you have a shopping mall in Dubai and one in London, you're like that diversified. You're kind of like subject to the same underlying risks. If you have residential real estate in the Middle East and in London, it's a fairly different dynamic, I would
there is certainly an argument, and that argument can extend to sort of care homes, can extend to car parks.
Right, yeah.
And by gradually increasing the diversity of real estate as an asset class, you're potentially increasing its benefits to an overall portfolio, because as you allude to, it gets the underlying returns, the income returns and the capital returns are driven by factors that might be different from those that drive the office space.
I think ironically that the big new thing is what we'd call social infrastructure. It's stuff that governments used to build and own. And since Thatcherism, since the 80s, they've been privatized. So we started investing in student accommodation. Then we invested in rental housing, social housing, senior housing, doctor's surgeries.
Even jails, right?
Jails, you know, hospitals, medical property.
But it's not just in the UK. There's a trend around the world where private capital come and say, I remember a number of deals in France where somebody comes and say, I'll build a hospital and the government will rent it from me.
And it's part of the theme of investors looking for different sources of return. I mean, that's one of the reasons investors have drifted into infrastructure. I think at the moment, the accepted wisdom, I think you used this example the other week, that it's accepted that a port is infrastructure, but a marina is real estate. You could flip those around quite easily. And the reason you could flip them around is because essentially there's an arbitrariness to the definition, but they're all favored or increasingly favored because investors are looking for different underlying drivers to their
results. Which is why we don't know how big or valuable the world of real estate is.
Absolutely
because
not.
I mean, is
we don't even know the definition.
Is the floor of the ocean investable? You know, wind farms?
Yeah.
You know, there's no end to it, really. It's the value of the world. Just to sort of benchmark it back again, though, if we're talking about 220 trillion as the valued size of the global real estate market, that's probably two-thirds the size of the global equity market.
But often in practice, when we look at investors' portfolios, they classify real estate as core plus, value-add, opportunistic, and that looks a little bit vague. So can you say more about that?
Okay, so this comes from the idea of a risk-return graph. So if you imagine risk on one axis, return on the other, and you'd imagine an upward-sloping line, as you move up the line, you're going from core to core plus to value-add to opportunistic, so getting more and more risk. I think it's preferable and it's much more simple to think about type A real estate, which is the lower risk sort of real estate. It's income producing, higher quality. It's possibly held privately or maybe in unlisted property funds that are open-ended. There's not much you need to do to it other than collect the rent, and it's going to offer you a return of 4 or 5 IRR globally these days. Type B real estate is higher risk. It's aiming for higher return. It doesn't always deliver higher return. It probably earns higher fees. It might be linked to a closed-ended private equity type structure. It may not be income producing. It may require some refurbishment, some work to it. And the simple label buy, fix, sell is a great way of describing this sort of type B real estate.
The limited partnership structure is well adapted to this because you may need capital at unexpected times, and if you are in a limited partnership, you can call the capital when you need it to refurbish something or to add another piece of real estate to merge it in and things like that. While if you have a listed vehicle like a REIT, then it's not that easy to raise capital when you need it. And same if you have an open-end fund, it's not you don't even control at all.
A REIT is most likely to be type A real estate. It's most likely to be a format that's holding income-producing real estate.
And this is what is a bit confusing, because a REIT is a listed equity, but it invests in something that is classified as private markets, and so this gets a bit...
Yeah, but fundamentally they're the same, because I mean you've got a valuation difference. In that one, REITs are valued on the equity market, they're valued by the minute, by the second, whereas private assets are not. So you've got a difference in valuation methodology, and it's really just a difference in reporting, nothing more. The underlying assets, real estate is so diverse, it can offer you bond-like returns at the lower type A risk end, and it can offer you more higher risk or higher risk equity-like returns at the opportunistic end. Those two, poles on a range of different options have different portfolio effects. You know, they perform different roles in a multi-asset portfolio, with the lower risk real estate providing you with something that is closer to a bond, closer to a fixed income instrument, and the higher risk providing you something that's closer to private equity, closer to a levered play on the overall equity market. This range of potential exposures is something that possibly, at least now, differentiates real estate and also infrastructure from private equity, where private equity is anchored to one point in risk return space as a result of its fee structure, of its cost of capital, whereas real estate can deliver those sorts of risk and those sort of returns, or those sort of target returns at least, but it doesn't have to. You know, you can choose to take less risk, and that option is not as easily available within the private equity market.
And Andy, you are at the forefront of all the innovations and the pulse of real estate market. So what's new? What's frontier?
What's big and what's hot? We're all talking about climate change and climate risk. You know, which buildings are going to suffer in a world that's warming up and getting wetter. We're talking about prop tech. Talking about the impact of technology. The picture I'd like you to get in your mind is billions of rooms, billions of people, and no way of connecting them until the App Store comes along. And as soon as you've got that, you've got Airbnb, and then you've got WeWork, and then you've got this whole shared economy piece. And then there's real estate fintech, crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, tokenization, blockchain, you know, all of that stuff. So there's plenty of stuff going on in the prop tech world. And then we're starting to think more and more, I think, in a world that's got an increasing divide between rich and poor. We're starting to think more and more about social impact and how do we measure the impact of doing the right thing in real estate investing. And I think it's not a stretch to say that real estate is probably the world's biggest impact investment.
I hope you enjoy and learn from listening to our podcast today. Thank you for listening to the Private Markets podcast series from the Said Business School at the University of Oxford. You can also send us your questions and feedback at sbspodcasts@sbs.ox.ac.uk. That's sbspodcasts with an S @sbs.ox.ac.uk.